Welcome to Defense Unicorns, a podcast for mission-focused innovators. We educate, inform, and provide mission heroes with DevSecOps, cybersecurity, and organizational transformation stories from the world's leading problem solvers. I'm your host, Michaela Flatteau, and we are so excited for you to join us on this journey. What's up, everybody? I'm here with our guest today, Rebecca Lively, who is the former deputy director at the Air Force's Shadows Edge Software Factory. Rebecca, I am extremely excited to talk to you. You are someone that I've followed on LinkedIn for a hot minute, and I really enjoyed seeing your content, and I also really enjoyed seeing your passion. I would love to hear about your career journey, how you got to deputy director of Shadows Edge, and then what you're doing now.
No, that's awesome. Thank you for the question. And thank you so much for having me on the podcast, because I'm also a Defense Unicorns podcast fangirl and a Michaela fangirl, which I'm sure makes you feel great. My career journey is a weird one. And I say that mostly because sometimes I get folks asking me like, okay, so if I want to be the deputy director of Shadows Edge Software someday, do I need to like do all the things that you did? And the answer is like decidedly no, because I have no idea like how I could have predicted where I ended up based on where I've gone. When I set out to figure out like what I wanted to do when I grew up, I was in high school kind of thinking like, what should I do? What should I go to college for? And I took a class in like software development. It was actually like the back end of like Access databases and like how to do really crazy stuff with them. And I loved it. And then I looked at what jobs paid a lot of money. And it turned out that like software development was one of those. And I was like, all right, like two for two, I'm going to go major in computer science. So I started college. I put computer science. I went to go meet with my advisor. And my advisor said, hey, I noticed you put computer science. Did you know that's a really hard major and that there's a lot of math? Have you thought about switching your major? And I was brand new, freshman in college, super young, even for a freshman in college. And I just looked at her and I was like, oh, Matt, I guess I should change my major, without even like going back and critically analyzing for myself that like, wait a minute, I like math and I'm good at it. That didn't enter into the equation. So I switched my major to information systems, which still has a huge like software focus, but much less like of a deep technical focus. But I loved it. I loved writing software. I loved the fact that if the computer says you're wrong, and it doesn't matter how much you argue with it, you have to figure out why you're wrong and then get it right until if you want your code to compile. And there's no debate, there's no discussion. You're either wrong or you're right. And it's an objective fact. I enjoyed that fact, that truth. But then in my last year of college, I had a quarter life crisis, is the best way I can describe it, during a database administration class. For those who don't love it, which is everyone, database administration is like the worst thing ever. And at the time, it was the best paying job you could get out of college. And I hated everything about it. And I said, is this really what I want to do with my life? And so I went home and I talked to my mom and we had a couple glasses of wine. And she said, why don't you just go to law school? You've always really liked to argue, which, pro tip, this is a terrible reason to go to law school. And so I said, you know what, mom, you're right. Like, I went and it was literally the last day to apply to go to law school the next year. So I wrote my application that night, post two glasses of wine. I signed up to take the LSAT and I went to law school. It was, and the reason I share the context is it was an incredibly impulsive decision, defined a huge part of my career. And I think that's an interesting fact. So went to law school, actually loved law school, graduated and combined what I'd learned with software development and like a technology-focused bachelor's degree with what I learned in law school and did intellectual property litigation for 3 years with a small boutique firm in San Antonio, and then decided I needed to figure out, what do I want to do for my career? And is it litigation? And is that compatible with having a family? And the answer for some people is yes. For Rebecca, it was no. So I just started like looking. A friend of mine pointed me to USA Jobs, and I started just cold applying for jobs that I sounded somewhat qualified for. And as I think a lot of people do, my applications went into a black box of uncertainty and I almost never heard anything back. And I was applying a lot of other places at the time too. And then I saw this job that was nearly complete gibberish on the USA Jobs post. I literally didn't understand half of the acronyms that were included in it, but it was in San Antonio. It sounded cool. And it was 11:58 p.m. on the date that it was due. And I hadn't properly tailored my resume. And my husband said, you should probably just go for it, because if you don't apply, you're definitely not going to get it. And I was like, cool. So that's the job I applied for. That's the job I got. It turns out there was some sort of like bureaucratic issue where they couldn't update the position description to what they were really looking for because of reasons. And so instead, they advertised what they had, and what they were really looking for was someone who they thought could ghostwrite them a patent. And I had been doing 3 years of intellectual property law. And so they were looking for Rebecca, and they got Rebecca. So that's a very long-winded version of how I got to the Air Force many years ago. I then spent 7 years at that job doing all sorts of fun, like cyber law stuff. I then transitioned to 16th Air Force, which at the time was 24th Air Force, which is Air Force's cyber, and spent 3 years there, again, doing like cyber ops law. But the entire time, I didn't stop loving the creativity and the agility of software development. And honestly, the fact that sort of objective tie to reality that you get when you write software, the fact that the computer is the only one who gets to tell you if you're right or wrong. And so I kept my eye out that entire time for ways to transition from practicing law to doing things that are more cyber focused. I made some, you know, pretty good connections in the cyber community. And so I just started applying for jobs that sounded exciting, that were more leadershipy and definitely not lawyers. And I kept getting rejected, like not even interviewed and then rejected, but just like cold rejected, screened out before anything. And what USA Jobs tells you when that happens is you were determined to not be qualified for this job. And so every time that happened, I said, okay, I was not qualified for that job. I'm going to have to get better. I'm going to have to get more qualified. And then next time I'll apply and maybe they'll decide I'm qualified. What I didn't do, and what I think I would do now, but I was less perfect then than I am now, which is still highly imperfect, is I didn't reach out to any of the hiring managers and just say, hey, I noticed that I'm completely unqualified for this position that I thought maybe I could do. What was going on? So I did that for a couple of years, decided that maybe I just wasn't qualified to be anything other than a lawyer. And then right after COVID started, I saw a job open up in literally my favorite squadron in the entire Air Force. And it was at the time, and it only solidified that it was later. And it was for their deputy director. And so that was the 90th Cyberspace Operations Squadron and what ultimately became Shadows Edge Software. So I applied. I had gone from very hopeful the last few times I've applied to jobs to certain I was unqualified when I finally did apply for this job. I knew tons of people who were also very well qualified. It genuinely felt like just a YOLO application, very similar to the first one that brought me into the Air Force in the first place. So much so that like, I didn't even tell my husband I was applying for a job. I didn't think it would happen. And sure enough, I got an interview. I got the job. And so then in 2020, I went and became the deputy director for Shadows Edge Software, or again, at the time it was the 90th. And it was once again, just like a borderline impulsive career decision that has defined where I'm at now and made me ridiculously, honestly happy to put all of these weird, disparate parts of my life together into one package that when I'm not on a podcast, I can, when I'm in a job interview instead of on a podcast, I can make sound really great. But apparently on a podcast, it sounds like a giant mistake.
First off, not a giant mistake, actually a very incredible journey. Shoot, like software, deputy director, lawyer, all these different things stemming from what you went to college for. I think that's actually pretty incredible, and I don't think you're giving yourself enough credit. Talk to me about what you're doing today. So where did you go? I know you left the government. Can you give me a little bit of insight behind that decision and where you went from there?
Yeah, I left off my last answer. I got the job, which for me is never the goal. It's really like, why did I want that job and what did I hope to achieve? And there's always different elements of that. So there's the, what do I hope to achieve for the mission? What do I hope to achieve for the people there? And then what do I hope to achieve for my own like learning and knowledge and development? So for that job, What did I hope to achieve for the mission? I didn't know yet. What I knew was it was a super cool mission, but I didn't know, like, I didn't go in like a lot of people do with like my own agenda of, oh, here's the six things that I'm certain are broken and I'm going to go in and personally fix each and every one of them. I went in very curious. For the people, it was my first leadership role. I'd had like one or two direct reports, but I had never led at the scale of a 240 person organization. And I, like, that's not something outside the government. That's not an opportunity you really get. Like, hey, we're going to take you from completely unproven, no leadership experience to you now supervise 240 people. Best of luck. So what I knew was that I had a lot to learn and that I just wanted to make sure that I put people and their careers first. And that was really like the only thing I would have been able to articulate at the time. For me professionally, I wanted to learn. I wanted to learn how to be a leader. I wanted to see if I was good at it because I didn't actually think I necessarily would be. And I wanted to see if I had skills that translated outside of the legal field. After about 6 months there, I felt like I actually like occasionally, like maybe 2 out of 5 days knew what I was doing. And I wrote what I call an exit letter. And it's a really weird concept, but it's been super helpful for me to focus my efforts. So basically what you write in an exit letter is you write it as if you're resigning and you recap what you've done while you're there. And so I wrote 6 months into the job, an exit letter that talked about all of the things I wanted to change, from reclassifying civilian employees that could get better pay, increasing our talent density by filling vacant positions with like really great hires. And then one of the big things we did was move from an on-base facility to downtown San Antonio into a commercial space that had windows, which turns out had been one of the things that our folks had wanted for a very long time. So I wrote all of that into this letter as if it had been accomplished. And then I got to work trying to accomplish as much of it as I could. And when I got to the 3-year mark, I went and I read it. And I hadn't done everything, because if I had, honestly, that would just be nuts. But I had accomplished like a lot of those original objectives. And when I thought about writing another letter, like there was nothing I looked at and I was like, I could do that. Like, I'm uniquely qualified to fix that. Instead, I looked at the team that we'd built and I saw other people who could achieve those objectives at least as well, if not better than me. And that was my realization that I needed to go, because otherwise there's so many civilian employees I've known in my life who don't leave at that moment and who stay. And I wanted to make sure I never became one of those people who's just like, yeah, 20 years ago, we really accomplished a lot of stuff here. And I've just been hanging out and resting on those laurels ever since. So I knew it was time to go for that reason. So where did I go? I was very deliberate in trying to figure out what was next. And what I ultimately selected for was finding the place with the highest talent density that I possibly could. So like the place that was making the best hires and then retaining those people. And that, surprise, is the Fence Unicorns. And that's how you were able to secure 2 hours of my day to do this podcast.
I think I saw your post on LinkedIn and about leaving the government. And that was my cue to jump in and say, hey, friend, let's go. I know your talent. I know what you're good at. I know who you are. I want you over here at Defense Unicorns. That was a big win. That was a big win for me, by the way, was bringing Rebecca on.
It was a big win for me, too. I'm like still pretty ecstatic about it.
And very, very much a win as well, because I am used to what you had illustrated in your journey. Some of those nuances that come with trying to get talent in the government, in USA jobs, and sometimes not being able to get the best talent because there are still folks there who are coasting and not really making room for more innovation, more changes. And that's where Defense Unicorns acknowledged, hey, we're still working with — not Defense Unicorns is working with, by the way, but the DOD is still working with ages-old software and hanging their hat on that as if that is the innovative thing. And we're saying, hey, no, this is actually pretty scary. And compared to some of the countries that we may be going to war with, that is frightening and we need to do better. And so I am happy that you are here, part of the team. I did want to dig in a little bit on some of the things you said. I found leaving the government that there is a big change from going from an organization where I was a small innovator, little fish in a big pond, and I felt like I had good ideas. I wanted to make a change. I wanted to do good by the DoD and get us forward. But I felt like I didn't have an impact. And I felt like I was surrounded by people who honestly didn't care. Like, they were there to clock in and clock out. And they were like, this is a nice, cushy government job. And I just didn't see that mission connect. And so coming to an organization where arguably almost everybody here at Defense Unicorns, no, I will say everybody here at Defense Unicorns, has that understanding, has that mission connect, and understands like the root of why we do what we do. It's very interesting coming from a place where you were an innovation superstar to coming here where almost everybody's an innovation superstar. And it's a little bit humbling as well. And I think that leads into some of that imposter syndrome. I'm going to label it imposter syndrome that people like you and I experience throughout our careers.
No, I think it's such a good question, because coming from Shadow's Edge, like, we actually did an incredible job of building a team of innovators within the government, which is almost impossible to do. Like, we had incredible talent density. Yeah, no, and like, it's for so many reasons. We had incredible talent density. We had some of the very best, smartest people who literally would regularly turn down offers for $50,000 and $60,000 raises to go to other jobs because they wanted to stay with the mission. And I felt like a big part of my job there was to almost protect them from like the machine that was the rest of the Air Force. And I think that, and then looking around at, not necessarily peers, but like other civilians in key positions, and the mentality that they had towards their folks was very different. And so I always believed I worked for my team and I worked to protect their time so that they could do the deep technical work. And when I looked around at other people in other positions, and not all of them, I actually had an incredible leadership chain all the way up to the MAGCOM level. But there were still lots of other members of the frozen middle, I guess is probably a friendly way to put it, who believed their teams worked for them. And burdened them with all sorts of like reporting requirements and like just spreadsheets to fill out. And the result is I have crazy deep imposter syndrome. And so like when I would spend time with the technical folks at Shadow's Edge, like I knew I was the dumbest person in every single room that I was in. And I like went home and slept okay at night, because then when I looked around at like other people in key leadership roles, I'm like, okay, at least do it a little bit better than that. And I could almost like rack and stack myself in my own brain of I'm definitely in the upper 30th percentile, like I'm doing okay. And transitioning to Defense Unicorns has been like a very weird mixture of like deep imposter syndrome and just incredible, like humbling exposure to mission focused people, to the point that like I'm now the dumbest person in every room everywhere I go, which is cool, except for maybe this one, Michaela. That's a joke. But so there's that. And then I think just the focus means, it used to be I'd ask, hey, can I get some help with X, Y, or Z? And the arguments that I would get against are like, oh, I think that's against policy. And actually, have you run that by the JAG? And there's a prohibited personal practice happening there. And now instead it feels, which there wasn't, but now instead it feels very much like everyone's just like trying to get to the same end goal and bringing what they can to the table so that I don't need to carry everything myself. And it's an incredible and terrifying feeling.
First off, I'm absolutely going to remember that you think that you're the dumbest person. Unless you're in the room with me, then I'm the dumbest person. Thanks a lot.
And we're just muted, so they couldn't hear you laughing. And now the entire podcast universe is going to think that I'm a giant jerk.
You're always a giant jerk. No, I'm just kidding. But you know what? I just have to say, in spirit of Women's History Month, did you know that Forbes says that 75% of U.S. women execs have imposter syndrome? Fun fact there, just had to throw it out. It's the month of March. I can completely understand where you're coming from. And I felt that as well coming to Defense Unicorns. I had a mental talk with myself of, hey, this is not this work that you're doing, Michaela, that's being seen as great here, might not be great at Defense Unicorns. It might be average when you're surrounded by so many smart people. It's incredibly humbling, but also I had to have the talk with myself of, this is going to be an incredibly uncomfortable place, and it's going to push you to have to grow a lot. So how do you feel like you utilized that imposter syndrome to propel yourself forward? Because I know you're not giving yourself a lot of credit, but if you look at your career journey and look at the types of roles that you held, you're not really the dumbest person in the room.
Depends on if you're like going for Harry Potter trivia or see, this is, you're exactly right. Cause I'm doing it and I have this huge tendency to be like downplaying my own accomplishments. What I would say is it's a strength once you stop trying to make excuses for yourself. So I spent a lot of time like trying to convince other people that I'm just as terrible as I sometimes think I am. And that really doesn't help anyone. But what actually gives me a lot of joy is being able to lift other people up. And that feels good. And it doesn't trigger those feelings of inadequacy. And it lets me like look around and be like, oh, like, how can we all be better together? And what's been another thing that I think has been really fascinating since I came to Defense Unicorns is I've been trying to set up a time to talk to all of the new hires in my area. And every single one of them, we talk about imposter syndrome because every single one of them is feeling exactly how I did when I got here, to the point that like I could almost like play the conversations on repeat of, I think they made a mistake hiring me. I think like I look around and I don't know what I bring to this team. There's so many incredible people here. And it's an eye-opening conversation because I feel like I'm talking to myself. But what I'm realizing is like these imposters, and we are all in our own ways imposters, they might very well be like the very best hires that a company can make in a lot of cases, because they're all very humble. They're all very willing to assume that they're wrong in a situation because like they themselves believe that they're wrong in that situation. And so they're really good at listening to other perspectives and elevating those voices. And then I think often like folks with imposter syndrome are some of the hardest working people out there because they're trying to prove not only to the entire rest of the world, but to themselves that they belong in the rooms that they're in. And while that's probably a conversation to have with a therapist too, it's also a really great way to stay motivated and engaged at work.
I just had an interesting thought. This is actually something that we look for in interviewing talent for Defense Unicorns. And in the current way that the Air Force does hiring, this is something that's very, it's missed. This type of servant leadership, imposter syndrome, like that humility to really put the mission before self and also go into things with a curiosity mindset. That starts by, with exactly what you said earlier, that self-assessment on USA Jobs, where you have that scary thing right when you start it of, hey, if you lie, then that's against the law. Okay, now rate yourself out of no experience to being an expert in all these different things. And first off, for clarification, I just want to let everybody know that all of those things are little snippets taken out of a position description that was written. Some of these position descriptions were written in the 80s and 90s, so not even accurate to the technological advances that we're currently working with. So that's why you may see a job posting looking like complete gibberish. That is why. And then you're, as someone with imposter syndrome, as someone with that humility, you're not going to rate yourself as an expert, but know that there are people who will rate themselves as expert on everything because they understand that is the only way that their resume is going to actually be seen by a hiring manager. If you're not marking yourself as expert, you're very well weeding yourself out of the process compared to people who might not be as honest, but understand the system a little bit more. That's how they're making their way forward. And by the way, I am not telling everybody, hey, rate yourself as expert on everything, because that's probably not honest in most cases. But I am seeing people going around. It's a flaw. It's a flaw in the hiring system that sets the hiring system up for failure right from the get-go.
I see it almost as like we select for confidence in the federal government. And that weeds out people with imposter syndrome. And it often weeds out women more than it weeds out men, because women are like statistically more likely to rate themselves lower when they do self-assessments. Or I would say more accurately, depends on your perspective. So we almost like the only people who even can be seen by the hiring managers are the ones who are the confident enough in themselves, or who know how the system works, to rate themselves all fives on those, which I also wouldn't tell anyone to perjure themselves, and you do sign those under penalty of perjury. But what I would say is if the entire system is broken, that perhaps it's okay to acknowledge that and operate in that broken system accordingly if you'd like to be considered for a federal job. One of the things that the 90th, and I know I keep going back to like why it was a perfect place, and in many ways in the government, it absolutely was. But like we had direct hire authority. And so we were able to find our own external only, but we were able to find our own external candidates, give them like a technical and cultural vetting, and then bring them in directly without ever having to go through USA Jobs. And I think that helped us result in a much more well-rounded and diverse body of personnel than had we had to go through that system. But occasionally we would have to use the system. Like if we were wanting to consider government employees, you had to go through USA Jobs. If you were wanting to consider one of your own folks for promotion, you had to go through. And actually, the very first time I learned that was the sole way that most of the jobs are screened. So basically, I don't know if we were totally clear on this. If you go to apply for a job on USA Jobs, you submit your resume and then you get sent, at least within the Air Force, to this questionnaire where you have to rate yourself on all of these different skills, as everything from I have never done this, I have no experience, to I am considered a subject matter expert and others ask me for advice on this topic. That's the range. And when I'd always assumed they were just asking to get a kind of gauge of how things were, and that wasn't a sole like the screening method. So when I learned, it was after I got to the 90th that I learned it was the sole screening method for whether or not I as a hiring manager could even see a resume. I replayed all of these past job applications that I'd been rejected for and realized that that was all because of my own self-assessment, which was fascinating. The way I learned it was we had we opened it to the public, but we had two really well-qualified internal candidates for one posting. And we posted it. I asked them to apply. They told me they applied. I got the list of applicants and they weren't on it. And so I reached out first to them and said, hey, are you sure you applied? And they're like, yes. And then I reached out to the Air Force Personnel Center, and the specialist I talked to told me that the words he used were, oh, they screened themselves out. And I asked for clarification. And he's like, yeah, they basically told us that they weren't qualified, so we didn't give them to you. I was like, all right, well, I'm the hiring manager and I work with them every day and I'm certain that they're qualified. Can I please have their resumes? And at that point, the answer was no. I later learned that there's things I could have done to get their resumes. So if you're a hiring manager, pro tip, keep asking, like you can do that. But they were very humble people. And the people who made it through didn't have any relevant experience that I could hire from. So it was super frustrating as a hiring manager and probably more frustrating for them.
I know most of our podcast episodes center around accelerating software in the government. And sometimes these episodes might seem a little off track because we talk about hiring, we talk about talent, but one of the biggest parts of why software has not accelerated, or is honestly just starting to accelerate in the DoD, is because of the talent management problem and the problem getting those key people into those roles where they can perform and not be bogged down by bureaucracy and red tape. And it's very So I heard from someone once that the problem with hiring is that people are just not patriotic enough and they're not willing to sacrifice for the mission. That's not the problem at all. When you have, first off, big giant tech companies who are promising a king's ransom salary, and then also the clear runway to really experiment with building software, it's very hard for someone who's wanting to potentially impact the mission to turn that down to come to a place where they're getting paid significantly less. And there's so many barriers to innovation that they have to fight that they're not able to just simply build better products to accelerate progress for the mission. They have to fight every step of the way. Do you have more insight into that, being a prior deputy director for a software factory?
I think what you said is so insightful, because to me, like, you can't accelerate, like, software is built by people for people. And so it is there are technical problems, but there are also organizational problems. There are bureaucratic problems. There are will and motivation problems. Like, at the end of the day, if you don't have the right people, you are never going to build the right software. And I think one of the really interesting things about, like, talent management culture in the military is it operates on a bell curve mentality. And so there's a fixed number of airplanes. The world's best pilot can only fly one airplane at a time. And so no matter how good you are, the impact that you can have is always going to be limited to that one plane at one time in linear space, time, whatever. And that's true for each of the services in their own way. They're very equipment and hardware centric. And talent management is tied to that hardware. So what defines a traditional air squadron? Like, you need all of the people for the number of airplanes that you have. And more people than make sense for that airplane won't make the problem better. But substantially less will actually make the problem a lot worse. And so even if you're bringing in someone who's not really qualified, not really motivated, so long as they show up and they can bring the parts where they need to be, or they can do the checklist items that they need to do, the actual talent level of that person isn't that important. And so when you take these talent management structures and you put them onto software, which, rather than the bell curve, how I've seen software work is the power law. And that's where literally, like, the curve just keeps going. And the best software developer in the world can have an impact 100 or 1,000 times more than a much more junior or entry level person. And so that's how we need to manage talent for software, which is that talent density idea. And the more of the high talent people you have, the more that you're going to attract, because brilliant people want to work with other brilliant people. And retaining those people, like, they all have choices. And so if you have this mentality of, like, oh, we just need 10 software developers and we're fine, and then you lose your three best and replace them with three average software developers, you've just destroyed your mission, your product, everything. And nothing about our current talent management processes consider any of that.
I want to tag on to something that you said. Software is built by people. And I was doing a little bit of research on diversity in hiring. And I actually found that, and I'm going to tie this back to imposter syndrome. So women and people of color are less likely to apply for jobs that they don't think they're 100% qualified for. And they're going to rate themselves out of that self-assessment, which then is going to cause a lack of diversity in the workplace, which diversity in the workplace is not just a feel-good thing or like a token person that you could point at and say, hey, look, there's a woman, which is very funny to me, but I have to reflect. There was a time in the Air Force when I was pregnant and they said, hey, can you stand in the front of this picture? Because there's that representation of a pregnant woman there. But that lack of diversity contributes to bias in software. And I didn't even comprehend or understand that until I dug into it and did more research. And there was a situation of, hey, like this form is built to accept people's information and first name and last name is required. But hey, did you know in certain cultures, people only have one name? And so when they have to put a first and last, it's kind of biased and they're not able to complete the form to apply for the job. That leads to lack of diversity. That blew my mind. I didn't even think about it like that until I did that research. And then it just leads to a bigger problem in if you're building software for airmen, sailors, let's say 18 to 22 year olds who are the core of people coming into the Air Force or any of these branches of service who need that software to be able to keep themselves safe wherever they're serving their mission overseas. That's bonkers to me that just those specific things can catapult into a larger problem of software not necessarily fitting everybody's needs.
And I think the more your team lacks diversity, the less they're able even to imagine the types of problems or applications or anything else that could result from what it is they're not seeing, because they're not even able to see it. One of the things you mentioned about women are much less likely to apply for a job where they don't meet all of the qualifications is something I'd love to like expand on a little, because I first heard that I listened to a TED Talk and I can't remember whose TED Talk it was, but her essential point, if you Google brave or perfect TED Talk, you'll find this. But her essential point was like, women are taught to be perfect and men are taught to be brave. And so if you look at a job application, if I'm trying to be perfect, if that's my instinct, then I'm going to look and I'm going to say, oh, there's 8 qualifications. I meet 7.5 of them. Like maybe better luck next time. Whereas a man who's been taught to be brave is going to look at that and be like, all right, well, I meet 6 of 8. Like, that's pretty good. I'm going to go for it and see what happens, which is one area where I see like allyship being huge. So like when I applied to the job at Shadows Edge Software, I reached out to some men I knew who worked there and who I thought were qualified for that exact job. And I said what a lot of government employees say, which is, there already someone in mind for this job? And both of them replied with, are you thinking about applying? And I said, yes. And they said, please apply. Like we would love, like basically both of them were like, we would love it if you were here. Even though one, I thought that they were more qualified for the job than me. And two, I genuinely didn't think I was qualified. But that sort of lifting up and support that I got from them was a huge part of like why I even applied for the job. And that's something I think we can all do for each other is one, just education in general about the mentality. Because as soon as I learned that women are less likely to apply for jobs where they're not fully, completely 100% qualified, I stopped feeling that way. Like it was like, I needed to see it. I needed to hear it. And then I could overcome it. But until I saw it and I heard it, I just assumed it was true. And so I think that dialogue can help a lot. And then honestly, just supporting and encouraging each other, I think can be super helpful.
Reflecting back on my own experience, I moved up the GS system very rapidly from starting as a GS4 to in 5 years becoming a GS12 before leaving the government and coming here. And every single job except for one, I got because of networking and because of some of my mentors, whether male or female, pushing me to go into that role and like giving me that opportunity. Whereas I was applying on US jobs and I was getting rejected left and right. Funny story, I actually had networked, got into a role because the manager was like, oh my gosh, your experience is actually perfect for this role. The background you have, the context you have. I was moved into that role and it was a role as a resource manager. And then a week into that role, I got a rejection email from USA Jobs for that exact role saying I was not qualified. And my resume didn't even go to the hiring manager. I went outside and circumvented the system to get my resume to the hiring manager. So going back to say, trusting those people and also being empowered by those people to move forward rather than myself rating myself out of the system. Incredibly beneficial to my career. And I think that leaning on those key people to empower you. I remember last week I had a little bit of a WTF moment because, like I said, I had been following you on LinkedIn for a good while. And you were a former deputy director of a software factory. And I had texted you and given you some pretty solid, rounded advice. And then I had the moment of, holy crap, look at me, Michaela over here. I very much like to talk poorly about myself all the time. For the sake of humor, I like to think that I'm funny. But a little bit of an imposter syndrome moment of, wait a minute, I was giving advice to someone who I think is way cooler and way smarter than me. Maybe I'm not as trash as I think I am.
Admire the bravery that it takes for you to share that, because it's just so completely different than my own experience in that same conversation, which is, so one of the ways my own imposter syndrome manifests is I am highly conscious of other people's time. And I really never want to be the reason that somebody wastes their time. It's like meetings is one of those times that I'm like, I never want to talk because I never want to be the person who, like, everyone's like ready to go to lunch and I'm like there pontificating on like how great my ideas are. And so that same exact exchange, and you're giving me advice. And what I'm thinking is, I'm so grateful that Michaela is giving me her time to think about my problem and how I should approach it. That's what I experienced. And so it's hilarious to me that you're thinking, wow, like, I'm worthy of sharing my opinion. Oh, wow. That's no.
I'm cackling over here on my muted microphone. Goes to show that people have severely different perceptions of the way that they're approaching their workplace versus how others respect them. I do think, though, that not trying to talk about specifically myself or specifically you, but that type of humility, approaching problems with curiosity and being able to admit that you're not the smartest person in the room, creates a culture of great ideas being shared. No echo chamber. We don't want to just hear the one person repeating their amazing ideas and everyone parroting back at them about how incredible they are. And no diversity of thought there, obviously. It's just incredible. And I do, people who are listening, do think about that. Think about your perception, how you're being perceived in the workplace, and reminding yourself, hey, I actually have good ideas that deserve to be heard.
Not only do each and every one of you listening have good ideas that deserve to be heard, but I think helping to support other people to speak up is so important too, because in a world where, like, the only way for someone to speak up is for them themselves to become convinced alone that what they have to say is valuable, there's almost that ability to amplify other people's voices that I think we're not always, like, collectively across the government as good at as we should be. Of just, like, you know, especially if you notice yourself dominating a conversation, pausing, taking a break, and asking critical questions that will drive a dialogue rather than a confirmation of whatever it is that you just said, I think is so important.
Encompassing everything we just talked about, your career journey to where you are now. Bottom line, what do you think you would want people to take away from this podcast?
One of the things I'd like people to take away is if you're in a role to make, like, a hiring decision, think as critically as you can about what skills you need and how best to source those. If you're in a role to build an organization that's going to outlast your time there, think about how you can shape the environment that you're in to kind of bring more diverse candidates to the table at all. And what I mean by that is, like, one of my biggest frustrations when I was hiring in the government was, like, I would often get a list of applicants that was all men. And so at that point, as a hiring manager, there's nothing I can do to increase the diversity outcome. But what I can do is go and tell my story to people in high school or even middle school and talk about, this is what I look like. I can just basically be a representation for females in a highly technical field. And I think that in and of itself can be very helpful to increasing diversity, but it's going to take more time. And so I think, what do I want people to take away? Like, build the world that you would like to have, even if it's not the world you have right now.
I very much appreciate your time. I appreciate you coming on this podcast and talking to us and giving us more insight that we can take away and hopefully apply in our workplaces. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.